part of what I was seeing with contraceptives and abortion too. Well, I guess maybe to bring it back, like I had the question of like, it's really obvious that the meaning of sex is unitive, and it's really obvious that it's also connected to like procreation, like, but why that one didn't land as much for me, because it's not like every time you have sex you have a kid. Mm-hmm. So how is it that like openness to life is essential for the symbol? Especially because people will point out, and I think the Pope points out as well, like you could be in a situation where like you're just both infertile for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You just can't have a child. Like, does it mean that every time like you engage in conjugal love, like you're doing something illicit? And he's saying no. And I think it's because like, what is the symbol that you are participating in? As soon as you introduce contraceptives into the equation, like you are participating in a symbol with your body that tells you that fundamentally, like love is insular, mm-hmm. that love, does not expand beyond itself. Mm-hmm. That like love is just kind of me, 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 me. And I think this is really obvious that we've taken this kind of contraceptive insular notion of love, and this is just what shows up in all of our ideals of romance. Mm-hmm. Is extraordinarily insular, or just kind of the thing that you hear people say when people are getting married, because you know there's all this stress and like the parents want something and the mother of the bride and wants something, like it's just, it's a stressful day with all this planning, and everyone will always say like, well, you know, like it's just, it's your day, it's all about you. Mm-hmm. It's all about you and your story.
Well, no one tells men that, but yes.
Just the girls. I mean, to a certain extent, like, you want to be respectful of the actual couple being married, so I think that's appropriate, but I think when you listen to that a little bit more closely, like, you also are hearing something else, which is that, like, really, your love is just an individual enterprise. Mm-hmm. And it's all about, like, your romance, your pleasure, your story, your adventure that's isolated from your family and this social relationship. As if, like, no one else ought to have input into your story.
Yeah.
Your special day.
Yeah, right.
It's, like, the whole wedding ceremony, all of the things that you do afterwards, like, all this came from a tradition, from other people. Yeah. Other people have already dictated your entire day.
Yeah, totally.
It's, like, that's what you do at a wedding. You just participate in this huge social tradition.
Yeah.
How can you say it's all about me?
Right.
And I think that, like, that's an example of how we can see this this technology that we've introduced has really shaped our social imagination of what even, like, that day ought to look like. Mm-hmm. And I think that it also has, like, kind of further-reaching consequences, too. Is this a good time to talk about China?
Yeah, China. Let's go.
I think another way that it really hit home was... I became friends with this girl from China, formerly Sister Jolin, now Sister Catherine Marie of the Passion.
It's an awesome name.
Yeah. I loved talking to her. I loved hearing about what it was like for her growing up in China. And she just pointed out some things that I'd never really considered before. So she was the product of like a one-child family policy.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing about that growing up, like, oh, wow, isn't that awful? That's going on in China. Like, you can only have one child, and if you have more, then, like, that child is aborted. Wow, that's pretty horrible. And so, like, she grew up without any siblings. Your siblings were basically your cousins, because that's all you had. But what was really interesting is that when China figured out, oh, man, like, this policy is not sustainable, and they wanted people to be having more children, so like, all right, you can have two kids, two and no more. If you have no more, then we'll abort them, but you can have two. But people weren't really going for this. They still were just having one child, and this was confusing to the government, so they like eventually opened it up like three. You can have three kids no more. And still, like, people weren't really going for this. And she was pointing out that what happened is that once you had like a generation of families with just one child, the whole social economic order shifted to accommodate that.
Right.
So now you have a situation where parents have all their money to spend on one children. And so marketing steps up that way. Programs respond. Schools respond. Suddenly, being a child is a lot more expensive because you have all this money to devote to just one child.
And so institutions are raising their prices in response, obviously.
Like, and so when China opened up their policy to have two or three kids, nobody wanted any because, like, kids are expensive.
Yeah, right.
Like, you've changed people's behavior in a way that's, I don't know, you can't just, like, reverse it with a policy change. Right. Because now you've made it really impossible for people to be open to having more kids because now you, like, fundamentally can't achieve the lifestyle that you're supposed to achieve.
Yeah.
And people know this. And the other thing that she was pointing out, too, is that you've also created all of these jobs of the government workers who were imposing, like, the contraceptives and abortions. And if you were just like, oh, yeah, that was a bad idea, how about we reverse that? You can't just, like, take away all these jobs that you've now created. Like, you've embedded this into the economy. I think you see the same thing happening here. I mean, we haven't had an enforced policy, but it is true that since we have begun contracepting, everything in our social economic order has shifted to match the desire of, like, what, 1.2 kids. There's just this assumption that you have all this money and time to spend on your, like, one or two, maybe three children. And so having more than that, it's like we it's funny how, like, people will look at large families and go, wow, isn't that weird? It's like, well, it's only weird because, like, we've made it, like, economically impossible to do otherwise.
Yeah.
It wasn't weird at one point in time.
Right.
But now it definitely is weird because you can't keep up with the lifestyle.
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally. I used to think that there was just a ideological connection between homeschooling and having a large family. Now I realize that there's a very strong economic influence, like, because if you're not going to go the public school route, after a certain number of kids, there is just simply no private school, no Montessori school, no charter school that you can afford. And so, yeah, like, so it, I'm, you're right, like, the institutions don't really account for something outside of our habits.
So I think that's, it's helpful in starting to see, like, okay, so, like, we're symbolic creatures, and the way that we do sex changes the way that we see the other person, the other gender, and love. And we're also social creatures, so it might seem like this is something isolated to a particular act or something in private. But since sex is always connected to children, even the not having of a child, that's going to have a very obvious economic, social, structural consequences, like one that we're, like, living in today. Like, because we've introduced this technology, it is in part, like, the reason why it's so expensive to have a kid. Yeah, it's just really, I think, being able to make that tie starts to make sense of why God in the Old Testament would impose those kinds of purity laws on people, because he knows the output. He knows that if you set up these kinds of social structures, then it'll, like, make, like, these kinds of virtuous and more, like, wholesome ways of living, like, more accessible to people. But, I mean, the people themselves were ignorant of why those laws were being put into place. And I think what we're doing when, like, with this kind of technology is just we start participating in patterns, we start participating in symbols, and we have no idea what their social implications are.
Yeah.
Because we're just so focused on me and my individual experience, or, like, my own desire.
Like, you know, one of the obvious things is, like, when we added, when we took away from the symbolism of sexual difference, when we took away that permanence and said divorce is a normal procedural part of the sexual relationship, we didn't really perceive ourselves as inventing the suburbs and urban sprawl, but we basically did, because every every unit of a family that exists in one home after divorce, you essentially double the potential number of houses you can sell. And we've created a sort of very unsustainable, excessive like number of homes. And it's not something you know when you just say, let's change the teaching, let's, you know, mm-hmm. change the symbol a little bit, that you're going to have,
I mean,
these
it could have had it could have had a different effect if right. we were a different sort of society.
Sure.
But I think what's important is that changing the symbol really does leave its imprint in a very like institutional, structural way. Yeah. And it's only when we do that to an extreme that it's really obvious, like yeah. what happened in China.
Yeah.
This right. is so obvious. But since we haven't had something like that extreme or mandated in the United States, it's not something that you can really see. And also, like, you just, you kind of grow up with your world being given to you and you don't really
yeah,
question
it's
it.
Normal.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And every now and then something will break in and show the extremity. I remember reading there was a lesbian couple and they paid for IVF and they were suing because they were trying to conceive a female, but because of, I guess, mistake on the part of the producers, I don't know, doctors, wow. I don't know. Doctors sounds like healing, but they got a male and they went to the news and they said that they experienced this as rape, this male in them. And this is a very, I mean, it's disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'll just tell one more story and then try to synthesize them. I have a friend who, when he was young, paid someone, a woman whom he had gotten pregnant, to go get an abortion, and he put the money in her hand, but she spent it on drugs instead, and then ultimately had the baby. And this man has said in moments of that baby's born becomes, you know, his child. And whenever something goes wrong with this child, she's a grown woman now, a man will say, I knew this would happen because she's not supposed to be here.
Wow.
Which is, of course, you know, it is an extreme, yeah. but it is both of these positions, the idea that a child that you purchase is perceived of as the product of rape, and the idea that a child who is now grown in the world is perceived as not deserving of its own existence, of not being according to plan forever.
Mm-hmm.
That these are sort of extreme possibilities that I think show what it's right. like to live in our particular society, where what we've done is essentially introduce conditionality into the process, the normal way by which we make people, by which
right.
we, I mean, for the Catholic, collaborate in creation, but for, I think, the non-Catholic who doesn't believe that God makes people, it's just to say we make people through the imposition of plans and through, yeah. So I imagine at this point is there anything else we want to talk about before we try to make a connection to the question of transgenderism, or do we want to?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. I'll do my best here. Yeah. So in summary, the reason to read these documents is because they show a concern with the symbolism of the body,
mm-hmm.
which is a God-given catechesis, education, readying the human heart to be open to the adventure of other people, to be open to the other, to transcend our individualism, our individual self, and to ultimately be able to obey the fundamental commandment, if you want to think of it this way, which is love your neighbor, love mm-hmm. God and love your neighbor. This becomes difficult when anything influences us to think of the neighbor as resulting from a plan. Okay, so.
Or just control.
Control, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. So we have been discussing the ways in which these different forms of life, these different habits of being, create a certain lens by which to see gender, and by which something that from another perspective might seem totally alien and bizarre, like I can change my gender, or in this case especially, I want to focus on the feeling of failing at your gender, which would have been pretty bizarre, now seems possible. Mm-hmm. Like, here's our world. In our world, you can fail at your gender. You can, yeah.
I mean, like, you can, in the past, you could be like a bad man or a bad woman, but it's not like you could fail fundamentally.
Right, right.
You still are a woman. You still are a man.
Mm-hmm. So the way I would describe this is to first point out that gender has a very privileged significance in the person, because it is a surprise. Mm-hmm. So it's a surprise right from the very beginning. The first thing you know about a child is you don't know what it is, who it's going to be. It's very amorphous and gross looking when it's born. And the one thing that you say is it's a boy or it's a girl. And the reason for this is because the newness, the fact of its newness, the fact of it being a surprise that you could not anticipate, mm-hmm. Is present as a symbol in its gender. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, it's just the first thing that you come to know and that surprises you about the new life that God has wrought is whether it's a boy or whether it's a girl, which is why it's, there is an alarming amount of the desire to control and to crush surprise that's present both in the actual acts of genetic modification and in the practice of sex selection in mm-hmm. IVF clinics, which we should remember is not like a magical process. It's the process of creating multiple embryos and then killing all the girls. In America, we don't just kill all the girls. Sometimes we kill all the guys, depending on the individual desire of the mm-hmm. parent. But outside of America, where males are more valued than females, generally speaking, it's the females that are killed.
Right.
And so through the process of sex selection, you destroy the fundamental sign of the surprise. It's not a surprise. You chose it. Now, that's foolish. You didn't choose it. You just killed the ones that weren't it. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of illusion that we are willing to undergo in order to make the child the product, the commodity, the thing we want, the thing we deserved. Which is why I am not against finding out your baby its gender with an ultrasound. I simply point out, and this is all, that it can lead to this, it can sometimes introduce this difficulty into the possibility of disappointment. Not if you're open to surprise in the same way, because obviously you don't have to be disappointed by the results.
Right.
But I remember this sort of crushing feeling of being at a gender reveal party where brought my kids. And part of the game of the gender reveal party is everyone guesses. Now, mm-hmm. to an adult, you can say, I'd hope that you don't really care what the result is. You're just having fun. But that's not how kids perceive things. And so I had this experience where my kid is crushed that it turns out to be a boy or a girl. I forget which one it was. Because he lost.
Oh.
Now, that's just comic. I'm not saying, like, he's just a kid, right? So he won't, I think, grow up to do that. But you can see how we're all, like, willfully technologically creating this possibility within human life, which is, like, when we are...
Well, when you gravitate towards more control, you are also opening up yourself to more disappointment.
Totally. I mean, there's a reason that when Christianity first came on the scene, like in the Roman Empire, like the thing that they really had to fight with the Romans about was exposing their children that they didn't want. Like this is
right. They would just like any child that wasn't desired, you just put them on the street and let them die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had interesting arguments about this. One is that the child would grow up to be a prostitute, and then you, because you're immoral, would sleep with your own child, which is how they got the Romans, because the Romans had a horror of this. So it wasn't the argument I expected. You know, you're reading the Christians, like, I know what they're going to say. They're going to say that person was created by God and has dignity. Oh, no, that's not what I said. okay. But I think we can all see how gender symbolizes the newness of life of the new person. It's the first thing you know. It's the surprise. It's what you can't anticipate. And then in human life, gender, once again, being a man or being a woman, is experienced in the individual as a surprise and as something that goes on without us and that goes on beyond our control and that we submit to, that we listen to it and try to conform. Sometimes for men, this is through great agony and difficulty where you really want to be a man and you're not sure how. And so you're looking to models and you're striving for excellence in order to affirm that this thing that you have is real. And I think that's beautiful and important. And I think for women, it happens sometimes, usually with a little less agony. But a similar thing is apparent. And for both man and woman, puberty comes as this very shocking moment at which the body, whatever your plans were,
it's doing its own thing now.
Says there is a plan. And again, from a perspective where life is an adventure in which we respond to it as given, a very good thing given to us for the sake of a goal, which is ultimately union with God, then the arrival of something given is not just neutral, but is in fact exciting. Quite exciting.
Yeah.
And I think this is true. If you just look at the traditions, what we don't do now in puberty, it's like once puberty hits, 1 in 3 women in America start cutting themselves, and men generally start watching pornography. But those rituals weren't the rituals of all time. They certainly weren't the rituals of Christendom. The various honorings and rites of passage and movement from... Even sometimes the word was different, like you're not a maid anymore. You have a new role in society.
Different titles or
your hair, roles like in the, thinking of Christian Lavinstadter, where they take your hair down for the first time. And then with marriage, there's more changes. But the celebration of the fact that something that you are, but goes on without you, has happened. It's like, it's a joy because it is the thing you are given with which to work. You're given a challenge. It might be very challenging. It might be very hard. You might be a strange kind of man. You might be a strange kind of woman. You might be a very average kind of man, very average kind of woman. But that womanness and that maleness, I mean, isn't it incredible that it takes so long for it to suddenly spring up after, like, you know, 13 years of hanging out? Like, and suddenly, suddenly it's like, oh, I have to do something with this. Like, that's the most obvious part of puberty, is that the world kind of opens up at the same time because you have been given a tool almost. I imagine puberty sort of like a, I don't play a lot of video games, but usually there's like some crazy looking old guy with a treasure chest. And if you walk up to him and you talk to him, he's going to be like, okay, this ring makes you invisible. And then the game starts.
Yeah.
That would be cool anyways. Puberty has something of this effect. I don't think that.
Well, it kind of like initiates.
Who are undergoing in this.
I mean, like it initiates you into a new world. Like your own body has a new meaning. Like now you have the possibility for motherhood and fatherhood in a way that you didn't have before.
Yeah.
And it's again, not something that you control. It's just something that's given to you, whether you will it or not. But in a social order that just fears anything that you can't control,
right.
It would make sense that you would receive that in fear. And also, I think, too, like in a society that not only fears not being able to control things, but also in a vicious society, like you just become more vulnerable, like particularly women,
yeah,
I think. Like that's like the terror of puberty for women, is that like suddenly, like you become like the object of a gaze that treats you as an object.
Yeah, right.
That's not something that you can really affect.
Yeah, and
or
so
change.
Which, okay, so within this world, gender is the surprise of the givenness of life. It's a symbol of the givenness of life in a way that like our elbows aren't. It's not that our elbows aren't important. And in some ways, obviously, if you think about elbows enough, it's like, well, I didn't plan for elbows, and elbows are here nonetheless. But there's something about gender, about it as a the first thing known and as the surprise that comes upon us and that gives us a vocational direction. It's like it's not just something we have. It's something which requires us to act.
Well, it's a limit.
And it's a limit. That's right. Right. Like it is the place in which we are, we know that we are defined by the other. Mm-hmm. So like maleness is makes no sense and means nothing and is not a sexed reality apart from the reality of femaleness. Mm-hmm. And there's no femaleness without maleness. And so it's always the sign of our own creatureliness, of our own limitation. Yeah, absolutely. But again, that is also, as I think you've mentioned before, like limit is a sign or it's a part of what makes adventure possible because it gives life particularity and purpose. You cannot have an adventure if everything is possible to you. Mm-hmm. Limitation pushes us towards becoming a particular type. It is already particularization in mm-hmm. the body. And so its tendency towards marriage, which is just greater and greater particularity until finally you're like a person with a virtue and a character who only has time to do one thing, is like the fruit of what you already see present in the limiting power of gender in the body in the beginning. Okay, so they're all this is to say that gender has this importance as a symbol, and
like a symbol that actually does yes. something.
And the question that I want to ask is, what happens to the symbol when it's normal to kill children? Does the symbol change, or does the symbol signify something different? Does it have a different effect? Or is it totally irrelevant that we live in societies where we kill people who don't fit or don't belong or we're not ready for or are not coming at the right time or are sick through abortion, that we put a kind of human filter on life and only let out those that fit according to the human plan? Mm-hmm. Because abortion, you know, considered in the life of any individual is always... it's a difficulty, it's a tragedy, it involves their personal circumstance. Mm-hmm. And it is wrong.
But it's not like people are going through this with malicious intent.
I think largely no. But on a social scale, you have to see that what it teaches,
right?
What abortion teaches is that the life, the people who surround us are all survivors of abortion. Because they were all born within societies in which they could have been killed. Which means a parent today is the one who could have killed their child and chose not to. Mm-hmm. So when you parent today, when you have a relationship to a child who's yours, the very nature of the society and what it allows and what it encourages even is such that you look on every child, technically, and we can talk about degrees of which this affects us psychologically, but I just mean objectively,
like our social order does this.
Yeah, you look on children as those who were chosen because you could have killed them. Mm-hmm. And so every child becomes a chosen child, even if that choice is sort of passive. It's like you might say, oh, well, I'm Catholic. I never would have aborted. But from the perspective of the whole society in which you are allowed to have abortion, someone would just say something like this. Yeah, you're a Catholic, and by virtue of being Catholic, you made the choice not to abort your child. Mm-hmm. So it still was a choice about your individual desires. Your individual desires just happen to be modified by this thing we call Catholicism, mm-hmm. right? So every child is a chosen, wanted child. And that's actually one of the promoting sort of phrases with abortion, every child a wanted child. But there's a horror there that you just scratch the surface. Like, yeah, everyone's...
What about the unwanted children?
Every child's a wanted child because all the unwanted children are dead. And if they have Down syndrome, they're dead. And so in this world, what you cannot say is that every child is unconditionally loved. Now,
right.
you, and this is tough to clarify, because I'm sure as a parent, I certainly like to think that I love my children unconditionally. But, and I sometimes wish that I was the only thing, you know, happening with my child, but my child belongs to a society. And within the society, the fact is that we have added a filter of conditionality onto every child. Every child that has come to be today has survived an ordeal where they were threatened with death and then death was withheld. So, you know, we gave the condition, we often give the conditions of time. Like, we will be open to life if it's at the right time, or our education status, when I finish college, or according, I mean, most horrifically and understandably, according to the goodness of the relationship in which the child is conceived. So mm-hmm. as long as you are not a child of rape, as long as you are not a child of violence and or just not the relationship I want.
Right.
But the point is to sort of step back and just say, okay, well, what's going on here? What is the social structure? Where the social structure is which every child is a survivor, and the relationship to of the parent to the child is as one whom they could have technically killed. Mm-hmm. Now, I think this has effects on parenting, but I don't have like a science behind this or anything like that. I'm not pointing out what in what individual case what affects what. But
well, I guess what maybe you could say is that like what we've done is institutionalized conditionality and institutionalized control in the way that life and children are just conceived in our conception of them, like in our imagination of who they are. And so like, I think generally speaking, it's kind of like the idea that's lurking in the back of your mind. Like, I think, I mean, you see the same kind of attitude, I think, crop up in like Catholic circles too, when it's like, well, like natural family planning is just like the okay way to control my life. Kind of the attitude of like children and family being this thing that is supposed to be fundamentally under my control.
Yeah.
It seeps in even in that attitude when we are practicing according to the church's teachings too.
Totally. I mean, maybe the simplest way to put that is just parenting a child you could have killed is different than parenting a child you could not have killed. On the one hand, all of society encourages you to continue that logic of abortion, which says, if, I'll love you if. And on the other hand, prior to having an abortion society or a society of human sacrifice, you have everything in society encouraging you to unconditionality, to saying, I love you no matter what. As I accepted you first, I accept you now. Mm-hmm. As I regarded you in the first, I regarded you now. As I was open then, I'm open to you now. As I was surprised by you then, I'm surprised now. As I could never have imagined, hope, determining by some accidental feature of your life mm-hmm. that you are not worthy of life, I don't do that now that I parent you and I see all these accidental features and it turns out you're annoying in 793 different ways every day, but you're not someone I could have killed. So no thing that you do can sort of take away that fundamental affirmation. Mm-hmm. Now that's extremely important because in that first society where we don't have abortion, it's easier for parents to be like God, because what we know is that God says we are very good and he gives no if. And that fundamental affirmation is like the sun that shines on us and allows us to grow, because we're growing into something that's God is entirely open to us. He's just like, come to me. And we can rise up into that because we're not scared we're not scared of God at all. And we don't think that he's going to at some point sort of say, oh no, not like that. I don't actually love you when you do that. You know, like God wants us to be perfect. And so he doesn't like our imperfections, but not because he doesn't love us, but because he doesn't love us failing to be ourselves. It's precisely because he loves us so unconditionally. Like he's more unconditional in his love for us than we are.
Right.
We give ourselves all these conditions, but anyways. And so we are able to be an image of God to both our children, but also to people in general. Like the family is the school of charity, which means what you learn there is what you treat.
Go out and do.
Everyone else, because people all come from the same source. It's not mm-hmm. like we all come from God through families. So what you learn in your family is not just like it applies only here.
Right. It's not arbitrary. It bleeds out.
Yeah, totally. And so in that second society, society of abortion, it's made much more difficult to be like God. to be the sun that allows unconditional growth, we have to, in some ways, work more. And mm-hmm. I hope that this is pretty easy and simple, because the love for the child is real, and I presume it of parents, that they have it. And so you overcome wherever you started, and the whole isn't this just the drama? Like, everyone knows this is the drama of the first child, is that it's just destroying your selfishness and you're miserable and you're mad at that child. And sometimes you hate that child because you still have this conditionality. And I'm not saying like only in a society of abortion is this possible. I'm saying that natural.
If you're already in a habit of selfishness, which is, I mean, we just live in a world where it's like very easy to be selfish without even trying.
It's a structural, right? It's a structure of sin. And that selfishness is not just us like grimacing sour-faced because the child is awake and we want to be playing Xbox. Like, yeah, of course, mm-hmm. it can be that. But it is rather a very deep, almost like our Genesis story, is that we're individuals who are supposed to fulfill ourselves by being like, by rationally implementing the plans that we come up with.
Right.
And even in the church, people have this disease.
Right, because we're all modern.
We're all modern, so we all think of ourselves in this way. And so the child who is given to us grates against our preconceived sort of plan of individual self-fulfillment. Like, it's this complicated way of just saying it demands sacrifice of us. And we are fat and comfortable and don't want to sacrifice. And so we groan. We groan. The child is like pecuniary. And what good parents will do, and you know what my parents did for me, was allowed the reality of the child and the supereminence of the demand that the child put on their unconditional love to burn away painfully, purgatorily, all of their selfishness. Like, it's just like sex. It's a growth in mastery. Any parent knows mm-hmm. this. But when you have a child that you could have killed, then all of those same moments of purgatorial fire bringing you further and further to a perfection where you're most like God, and you're like, it's 3 a.m. and you just woke me up by headbutting my teeth and are crying, and I love you so much, no matter what. Those moments don't receive the same social support, the same social sanction. But rather, it's more just easier to be tempted to just stay in the selfishness, to stay in selfish parenting, and to say, you know, essentially, like, why are you doing this to me? This wasn't my plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we don't necessarily think, because I could have killed you if I had known this about you. But that right. is the social sanction given to those attitudes. Every child was supposed to be a wanted child. Mm-hmm. Every child was chosen. We wait because we're responsible to have children by killing the ones that come when we're not ready. So the experience, which literally every parent has no matter what, of not being ready,
right.
suddenly has this experience of failure. Like, mm-hmm. I guess this turns out that this was a time that I should have killed you. I just didn't know it because I didn't know I wasn't ready, and I was supposed to wait till I was ready to have kids. Okay, so I hope in the extremeness of the formulation, we're not losing sight of the fact that this is like a malaise and a social like reality that's present just in our little reactions and our little reacting to the social world we're given.
Mm-hmm.
And that this doesn't come across as like, I'm saying all of you want to kill your kids. I'm right. not saying that. So if that checks out, and if what we said before about gender being a sign of givenness, like a preeminent sign of givenness, checks out, then I think it's just a simple matter of putting two and two together to address transgenderism. And the reason why, you know, in the hoary days of Humanae Vitae and Donum Vitae, there is present this worry, this concern of that we now see directed at transgenderism, that this mm-hmm. isn't like some other thing. Sometimes people can make a slippery slope argument without content, where they right. say like, well, we did this bad thing and then that made us bad, and so then the next bad thing is just a logical consequence. How is it logical? I don't know, but they're both bad.
Yeah.
and that doesn't do justice to the fact that we act reasonably, basically, like human beings act for reasons.
Right. Well, I think it kind of makes sense that if we we've introduced this technology into sex, which obfuscates its meaning.
Yep.
And obfuscates the nature of love. That's going to have a ton of, like, kind of almost like micro consequences.
Yeah.
In, like, we kind of talked about the economic, like, social order, the way that we, like, view the other gender, the way that we view sex, and then also the way that we view ourselves, because we are increasingly experiencing sex and gender as something that is under my control. Mm-hmm. And we're, like, basically socially conditioning ourselves to fear givenness.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's kind of the situation that we are all in.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense that transgenderism falls in that, because here you have, like, a given reality that you did not choose, and this is experienced, like, fundamentally as a threat.
Yeah, absolutely.
To my individualism. And it's not because I think, like, people are being selfish. Like, you're born into a social condition in which, like, when things appear in a way that you did not plan, that's bad. That's bad. Evil. It's a failure, and yeah. You need, as an individual, to fix this.
You need to lock it down. Right. Yeah. Because it's, I mean, think about it this way. It's a sign. It reminds us of our Genesis story, which we were born into conditionality, not into unconditionality. So when something happens that goes on without us and that we didn't plan, the fear is that this thing will make us no longer worthy of love. I don't mean that it's direct. I just mean that now we have something that once, like it's very obvious if you think about it in terms of sex selection. Like, if you live in a society of sex selection and you know that females are aborted for the sake mm-hmm. of males, then being a female is going to come with a great worry about your own worth. Mm-hmm. Do you really love me, Dad? Like, are you disappointed that I'm a girl? Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily think of this as a real possibility, but in other countries, that really is.
Right.
And I think if you can extend that logic to gender more generally, I think then you'll start to understand our society, because we do practice sex selection, but we're not mm-hmm. clear about which gender we want. So our concern, once gender comes up, is not, oh, I'm a girl, do you love me? But do you love the gender I am? Do you love who I am? Mm-hmm. Is that what you wanted? Our relationship to our parents is within a society in which our parents could have killed us if we didn't appear as what they wanted. And so when our bodies change, especially in puberty, you know, there's a certain security in childhood because you're pretty similar as you go along. Mm-hmm. You are who you are. Your parents loved you enough to let you live at the beginning, and they'll love you when you turn 5 and they love you turn 8. Then you turn 13 and now you're changing and you're getting weird and you're feeling weird and things are happening. So it brings up, obviously, the crisis. I mean, this isn't, I think, controversial. It brings up the crisis. Like,
right.
Am I still good? Am I still the thing you want? But the point is that we are in a position, our social order reinforces a position where we are critical of the givenness of our bodies, or we have the grounds with which to be critical mm-hmm. of our bodies. We can stand apart from it and say, well, I know givenness undergoes a great test in the beginning, and some people don't make it. Some people are killed. I'm not saying we think this through. I hope that's clear. I'm just trying to, for clarity. Some people don't make the, like, their givenness is judged and said, nope, you're dead. And so when we experience this, like, flow of givenness within our bodies, when we experience puberty, it's a prime time to almost revisit the primal scene, as it were, our mm-hmm. Genesis account, and undergo not the fear that we could have felt then, because we were embryos, mm-hmm. but the fear that I need to choose something that fits. I can't be unfitting to the plan.
Right.
It's not clear anymore whose plan, but you know you have to fit the plan. You cannot simply say, I know I'm loved. Mm-hmm. I am unconditionally affirmed in my being. Whatever flows forth from me, I know is ultimately good. You know, sin aside, like in my being, I am good. I am affirmed. Because that's not how we welcome people into the world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways you can sort of see this maybe is in the rise of like the necessity of therapy. And I don't mean this in the simple way of just saying like, well, everyone's sort of messed up and has daddy issues now, which, you know, they probably do. But one of the things that every therapist, and it is maximizing, mm-hmm. like this is, everyone's got a therapist. And then there's like now, especially the definition of the human person is as in need of a therapist. So I'm sure you're aware of the shift where people started saying everyone should go to therapy.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the things that is obvious there is that what that would imply is that human nature as such is in need of therapy. But why now? Why do we think that now? That certainly wasn't something we were saying even 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And one of the things therapists provide is something that they refer to as unconditional positive regard. Hmm. And there's reasons for this. I mean, therapists, feel free to join in the comments here. But there's a reason for it, which is basically that the first thing you have to do for the sake of healing is not say, oh, everything you do is perfect or anything like that. But
right. It's just to have this space of like unconditionally, I will love you, I will respect you, I will take seriously your experience.
You
are good.
You don't need to worry about you. It's really just the ontological affirmation. You are good. And in that, that develops the trust or allows for revelation that's necessary for therapy to work. Because if you come with conditionality, if as a therapist, you approach your patient and the patient's experience is he'll only listen and only love me if, well, then you don't have the conditions by which you can reveal everything, every bad thought, every horrible dream. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Okay, so this is obvious, but it seems to me like,
The reason why this is so important is because like this is increasingly lacking.
Yeah, or like at least people are feeling like it's increasingly lacking, right? Something about our society today lacks unconditionality in it, and we've literally developed a paid class of people to provide unconditional regard. And so it's these little things that make me think our world is characterized by a certain anxiety of being loved, and that there's no way that the fact that we kill people that don't fit doesn't ultimately socially produce the anxiety of being loved.
Like it's not as if like, yeah, as if something like that can have no effect. Totally. So it's not like everyone is like sitting there like logicking through, oh, well, like I suppose my mom could have aborted me.
Yeah.
I think that it is true that like there's more anxiety experienced about love because our love has become so much more controlled and so much more insular and mm-hmm. so much more about me, not because like people want to be malicious or want to be selfish, but like we're all just participating in like these symbols, these patterns that just like reinforce that kind of notion of love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just going to have like an effect on kind of our social consciousness. And then even, just the way that you encounter, other people aren't safe in the same way.
And just to go back to the main point, it certainly should be no surprise to us that the fundamental sign of our givenness is what's being seen as suspect and as ill-fitting to people.
Mm-hmm.
To live in such a society would certainly confirm that anything odd that you feel about your gender specifically is a big risk and needs to be taken care of quickly, because that's a symbol of givenness. One of the things that this means for us is that we have to remember that there is a continuity between the acts of I'm going to call them faithless, by which I mean like not Catholic, conservative people, and then the transgenderism of their children. Because it's easy for us to think that the kids went off the rails. Mm-hmm. They're crazy. Look at this. There's like 13% of people are identifying as trans or LGBT in high school. I mean, this must be just some copycat phenomenon or something like that, right? But that certainly would apply if we were talking about a Catholic population that was obedient to the church, to be clear, mm-hmm. and was virtuous too. So not a lot of people, sorry, we're all out of that list now. And their children becoming transgender, identifying as transgender. Because then you could say pretty clearly, like, look, these people are open to life. They are open to the surprise of their body. They are suffering. They're getting rid of their selfishness. Mm-hmm. Like their children are going nuts. What's in the water? But that's not the reality. The reality is that the generation prior to transgenderism, even in conservative circles, is contracepting.
Right.
So you're saying like, hey, kid, you know, don't you know that when you have female genitalia, then you're a female? And the kid's looking at his mom who is taking pills to shut down her fertility, who is having her fallopian tubes tied in order to right. make it not work. And you can't see that the one is connected to the other. It's like, yeah, sure. The previous person who stood and controlled all that givenness through medical intervention
like
wasn't...
She's just controlling it like as... a woman. And
yeah,
so
she's maintaining woman. So you can say, okay, there's a certain decline because now the child of that woman, when she identifies as a male, isn't like is doing something maybe more total, right?
Yeah,
saying
but,
I
mean,
am a
but
male.
But both are rejecting the givenness of their nature.
Yeah.
Totally. And rejecting the meaning of their sign.
Yeah. Which is like super obvious in that like. Even the development of things, it's like we're literally doing plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery to make ourselves fit. We are worried that we won't be loved if we don't carve ourselves into certain shapes. Like we already have the threat of abortion in our lives influencing us now to say what's given has to be locked down under our control if we are going to be happy individuals. And then the fact that some of the even the same surgeries are used to, you know, gender affirming surgery where they're cutting and reshaping and injecting and doing hormone regimens, the fact that like, yeah, on the one hand it's different because the person undergoing surgery is just trying to attain like a particular ideal that mm-hmm. is at least identified with their sex that they belong to, and the other person is trying to deny belonging within that sex. But the difference shouldn't make us lose track of the similarity.
Right.
I mean, it's just become very clear to me that the options here are either no Christ and then no gender or forget it.
Well, it just kind of reminds me of more progressive critiques of the church's stance. Like, okay, like you are so worried about transgenderism. You're so worried about gay marriage. What about divorce? Like, that's wrong for you guys too. I don't see you saying anything about that. What about like contraceptives? Like, that's yeah. wrong for you too. I don't see you saying anything about that. And I think that's a pretty good critique.
Yeah, totally.
that was a problem.
Yeah.
Or like even just like adultery and like infidelity in marriages just seems like such an obvious place where you're just like really messing up that family and those kids for the rest of their
life. Well, and you're saying that the symbol doesn't really symbolize.
Right.
You're saying, look, I know that the body appears to tend towards unity with the other, but I'm going to go undergo this divorce. And then you can't be surprised when the child says, look, the symbols that I see in my body don't really signify.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just make them symbolize something else. I'm going to control this. Like we all are guilty. We are all responsible.
Undermining the symbol.
Totally.
And it's, I think, important to see like how we've participated in that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that critique is a good one. That really is the place, like marriage really is the place like where, I don't know, like that just messing around with that symbol has so many terrible negative effects that it's really important to go back and heal that place, like the things, and it doesn't seem that consequential because it's just between like two people. It's just an act, or like just that individualistic mindset. It really does have far-reaching consequences.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, I think
we need to wrap up.
Probably at a place to summarize. I'm awesome. That's great. Okay, so in conclusion, if we can conclude from all that, one of the ways in which transgenderism seems normal
is that we've already just kind of destroyed the symbol.
We've already done it.
Yeah.
Like it can happen in different ways. I'm not diagnosing any particular case, but I know that the necessary step to saying of my body that this that I see that I'm given does not symbolize, but I can control it unto a symbolization that I fit with.
Mm-hmm.
That this condition is promoted through all of the what we tend to call life issues, mm-hmm. In the church, and our disobedience and our unwillingness to be the symbol that we are in IVF, in divorce, in abortion, and contraception creates a total social world. Mm-hmm. We can't avoid this. Like, you can't kill your kids and contracept the sexual act and not expect consequences in how people view themselves, because mm-hmm. the sexual act is the place that God has humbled himself to create. This is where people come from.
Mm-hmm.
When you mess with that, you mess with people, and you don't see it at once because we're usually blinded by our individualism into thinking that, well, it's just going to affect me, because that's actually the very premise of our sin, that right. isn't sex just the thing that affects me and I'm after to fulfill my desire?
Mm-hmm.
So it has this kind of vicious circle to it, right? And so to unsee the fundamental, like, what's the word? Like a imperative to control. We really do have to be converted. We really can't just say, "All right, you can control everything, and you can intervene in sex in this way and that way because the symbol doesn't matter." But in this one arbitrary place, you better not. Mm-hmm. You better let that symbol symbolize. What do you mean? Are you ridiculous that you have a penis, you have breasts, like this signifies, how could you deny this?
Mm-hmm.
The arbitrariness of it, given our complete disobedience to the church in every other moment where it says, hey, your body symbolizes, you should be a symbol,
right?
Because that's how we show God in the cosmos to others. Suddenly it's like, do that here and not there. We can't. We have to be consistent.
Right, right.
We cannot become a hypocritical people. I guess that's my takeaway. What's your takeaway?
I think coming back to the idea of the social imagination, the things that we do, the technology that we introduce, the symbols that we inhabit and live, it really does have a whole social impact. And even if we're ignorant of the thing that we are participating in, it doesn't mean that you can't participate in it and give it more force. I hope that this discussion kind of helps to see like how technology changes the way that we think and treat each other, not because merely of a like a slippery slope argument, because that's just, this is how human nature functions. Like when we take away natural barriers, like our sin and our weakness tends to overtake us, and when we start messing around with these like natural symbols, like truth about the human person, about love, starts to decline, and that can have like kind of permanent marks on our social structures.
Yeah, absolutely. So as usual, I keep coming to this, as usual, the lesson is we're all responsible.
Yeah.
So you pray for us and we'll pray for you, and we hope to see you next time on the next podcast. Goodbye.